You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry. Radio Tacoma KTAH 101.9 FM. I'm your host, David Gilmore. And here today we are going to hear many poems from Seattle poet Kuhn Woon, who is a founder, co-founder perhaps, of several publication organs, one of them the Goldfish Press and the Chrysanthemum issues, the very beautiful one, Chrysanthemum 2020 Literary Anthology. That's from the Chrysanthemum Literary Society. Kuhn, welcome you very much to Sound Poetry, and I wish to give you as much leeway to read as many poems as we can today.
Okay, thank you, David.
So, with all these works before me, I'll name some of them. Kuhn has a variety of small, very thin, and some very substantial works of poetry. Payment in Memories, Selected Poetry. Rice Bowls, that are previously uncollected words of Kuhn Woon. An omnibus of much of his poetry from all time that he has been writing poetry, Water, Chasing Water, and an earlier chapbook called The Burden of Sanity and Other Poems. If I told you any other works that he has, we'd be wasting time from listening to Kuhn's poetry itself, and so we want to get to that, Kuhn. And I'd really like you to begin, if you would, in The Paper Sun Poet, When Rails Were Young. And this one is the prologue, which I think is very interesting for putting us in a place. Kuhn?
Yes. Heng He Park is the center of Seattle Chinatown, and I spent many years in Seattle Chinatown, and this is one of the places I come to. It's called Heng He Park. Heng He Park. One of the places I've spent time orienting myself. Locate yourself inside a seaport city. Locate yourself inside the inner city. Locate yourself inside a small square. Locate yourself inside you. This is you. You are the dragon on the wall. You are the railroad when America was young. You are the immigrant hands that laid the tracks. You are here. It is you. This is a place where you come to. This is a place within you. You were here when the sky was born. You are here. You are you. America, I have no other place to go now, but to go within myself and find all that is still new. This is too a place for you as well as for me. You and I are both here. We are here. Of all the places where I have spent my time, of all the places that have bruised my heart, America, you're deep within my heart now. The pain was enormous. Yes, it was you. Now don't tell me to go back to Wales or to Bavaria. America, I'm now a native, as any native can be, to have withstood the pain and yet still be free.
Very welcoming poem, actually drawing the person in to that place and helping to bring the person then to enjoy being in a place that is for others too, place where you've spent your time and bruised your heart. But it does, I think, seem to firmly place you in your comfortable zone.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's nothing unpleasant about your being now a native as any native can be. You seem content with that. Is that true? You feel content this time in your poetry?
Yes, I do. I feel the worst is over, and the rest is enjoyment, contentment in whatever little times I've left to do good in poetry and whatever little thing I can do for the community.
You certainly help many young poets to get on their feet, but at the same time, you have such an abundance of poetry that you have published, and you even have new poetry that you've been writing recently. Tell us a little bit about coming about of your poems. I know that you've said that the muse is not particularly an important mystical figure in your creation, but would you read something that plays to that?
Yes, this poem is from my chapbook, The Burden of Sanity, and other poems that I self-published in 2004. In this poem, it's similar to a beat poem. Anyway, it's called How Can This Poem Come About? A necklace of lotus hearts. I bend her and back. In the sun falls, the category of freeway ramps. The slow smoke up from smokestacks. And how should I cogitate? How should I measure the rift that the heart and the mind are separated now? The secret language of a man with a premonition of his own death. One heart, he said to me, while he was on a horse all his life, viewing flowers, creating phantom armies that invade without warning. That man is gone now, and he had appeared to be a good man, an able poker player. And now the cranes are busy, the herons cry on the beach, yet it seems it was all a social matter, as easily to arrange as a dinner party. I am listening to my own music now. I see the infinite sadness that the dusk will bring to night. Some will not wake up after the dawn. How is sadness measured? As before, a chain of lotus hearts, the flying droves, view the changeless green sea below, that beneath the column of heavy water, lie deep are the early sunken Greek ships laden with treasures.
Left, we are to imagine what treasures are lying in the hulls of ancient Greek ships down at the bottom of a sea. So, yes, that gives you an idea of the range, the movement of your poems. In the one that we were looking at a while ago, it's the one that we can find in Water Chasing Water. The poem, If There Was a Choice, is from Water Chasing Water. Is this a recent poem, or is it one from...
This poem was actually written in 1997.
Right, so dated. Mm-hmm. Okay. But doesn't come across as dated. But let's hear you read that one.
If there was a choice. If there was a choice between reading about reality or seeing it touch its thought as braille. The volume of the world funneling in through a gap in the window, the old factories in industrial distance, the salt of the bay air. If there was a choice, I meditate on plum blossoms. No, I wouldn't view flowers on horseback, nor would I eavesdrop on the crescendo and song of song and dance behind the imperial door. If there was a choice, I choose to be poor, unnoticed, unrewarded, unfettered by ropes of language, social mores. No, if there was a choice, I would not obey the rules of pickpockets or dog meat vendors, paperback writers, insurance salesmen, tavern bouncers. I just amble, stare at the cracks of the sidewalks, and envision a dandelion shooting through, yellow and fine. Or imagine a blackberry vine in the inner city, growing okay without city rain. Heaven's pennies it abstains from taking. If I had some choice, I have a morsel of rice and some tea, hot or with ice. And from beggar to king, if the choice was really mine, I simply choose to be kind.
So there is a statement perhaps of a major value in the way you live. It doesn't matter what the other choices are, you choose to be kind. Have you found that during your years in America that kindness came your way often, easily, or was it sometimes a difficult life?
Mostly it's been difficult because of my mental illness for many years. However, and I believe it was 1993 or 94, I received a phone call from Wisconsin. A lady asked me, are you the editor of Chrysanthemum? I said, yes. She said, can I send you 20 poems, send you a story to look at? I said, sure. She sent me a story. I was in a hypomanic mood. I was kind of in a funny mood. I read her story. I wrote back to her, this story is so horrible. Please don't send me anything more for 5 years. So she thought that was funny, and then she kept calling me. And I found out she was a reference librarian, that she retired as a reference librarian. Her name is Betty Preby, and she asked me, do you write poems? I said, sometimes. So she said, can you send me something to look at? So I sent her a batch of 20 poems. She said, this is remarkable. We have to get you published. So she acted as my literary agent. She sent it to University of Hawaii. They wrote back immediately. It says, we do not do original poems, only translations from Asia. So the second place she sent it to was Kaya Press in New York. And they said, well, consider it seriously. And so they did. After 2 months, they accepted my book, The Truth in Rented Rooms, my first book, which won the, which the finalist in the first book award from the Poetry Society of America. It won the Penn Oakland Award. It was used for teaching of poetry, used as a textbook. Several colleges, including Bard College, Sarah Lawrence, and UC Berkeley, a couple of small community colleges. Yeah, so that was...
Famous places.
Yeah.
So they chose it as a text.
Yeah, they
excellent.
Chose it. Yeah.
Were they poems representative of your life, just as we have in Water Chasing Water?
Well, the, I have to confess that Water Chasing Water, the only 54 pages of new poems, and the rest of it is a reprint from the first book, The Truth in Rented Rooms.
All right. Mm-hmm. Would you please read about your life as a village boy from Water Chasing Water?
I assume everybody's played some poker in their life. And so anyway, this is I was supposed to be the best poker player when I was a little boy, but since, the teachers confiscated my deck of cards.
Oh.
And then because I was, corrupting the morals of my fellow students. Then I refused to go to school for 2 weeks, and they gave it back to me. They gave my cards back to me. But they said, I can't play cards anymore at school, so I quit. Village boy. I was the best poker player in my village before I attended the first grade. I was thrown into the village pond 3 times with winning. The teacher had confiscated my deck of cards for corrupting morals of my fellow students. Thus, I learned to recognize bluffing early. The first time you see death, it is real. But every time thereafter, it is false. When people want to talk to me about rules, I just smash them on the head. I'm famous among 80% of the people. Peavines broadcast my views. I dig a long irrigation ditch to bring water to my soul. And please, Mr. Postman, leave my letters from abroad with the city apothecary man, for when I need my medicine, presto, I get news. In lean years, I eat my pet dog. But when times are fat, red-cheeked girls from the nearest town sell golden melons and talk to me about sailing my wares down the Pearl River, with dragon boats cleared away. My lonesome crafting overripe bamboo will find the waterways all leading away. Though it will continue to rain for 99 years, for the mist and rains of a lifetime, a straw coat will do.
So these memories then that are revived in your mature poetry, as you read them, do they take you back to vivid images?
Yes, they do. My village had no running water, electricity. We grew practically all food. We bartered some of the food for other needed items, and there was not even one bicycle for miles around. Mm. So everybody walked everywhere and carried, two loads on the weaving a bamboo pole on the shoulder.
Yes.
And I remember we had famines and we had floods, and we have what they call the monsoons, which happened early summer. It would flood the entire village, the ponds, the wells, everything, the rivers, everything. It'd be quite dangerous to walk in the flooded water because you can just walk into a well, So.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's your exaggeration, then, though it will continue to rain for 99 years, right?
Yeah.
It seemed like it. It's mm-hmm. a 99-year rainstorm. All right. Now, when you came to America, you lived on the West Coast near Oak Street in Aberdeen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you read something from your later years that tells about the life in Washington State?
Flight. Oak Street never had oaks. This much we know about the street we lived on. Aberdeen in its encyclopedia refers you to Scotland, 19 years of it is visual purple. A shiver when you have the right answer in the high school math class. A 35-pound salmon on a 20-pound test line. A 1909 SVDB penny. Or the rain derby, guessing the year's rainfall to the nearest hundredths of an inch. An occasional carnival to keep the town buoyant, even though half the graduating class leaves Aberdeen. When they come to the Satsop River, a slender body like a nun's, never pregnant, not even in rainy season, they hesitate, but only for a moment, before pretending to be Alexander the Great crossing the Tiber. Channel catfish, either dig a hole in a muddy bottom, lodge themselves there, and vacuum the food that drifts away, or they swim downstream forever. Hank keeps coming back to Aberdeen for his limit of razor clams at Oi Hut, or to find his poker luck at the Spar, or to his ex-wives and two kids, or to bowl at the Harbor Lane with Frank the Tahola judge, or to the blueberry shrubs only he knows where in the foothills of the Olympics.
And this was what particular era of your life? How old were you in Aberdeen, experiencing?
I was Aberdeen from approximately 12 to 19, my school years, yeah.
And Hank was a latecomer to America?
No, Hank, the funny thing was I was the only sibling born in China.
Mm-hmm.
My dad and my mom came over when I was two. They left me to the care of my grandmother and my uncles. So Hank was the first born in America. He was my second brother. Unfortunately, Hank died early at age 48 of cancer. But his son now, Hank Jr., he's a notable person in Aberdeen, Washington, in Wikipedia. He's known as a writer, a game inventor, and a screenwriter. In fact, they're going to make a movie of Heng's, Netflix, pretty soon, one of his stories.
Good. Yeah. So this Heng played a pretty big part in some of these early poems, and there's that "What We Remember Best of You, Heng."
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's an important note to commemorate here in light of his short life.
Yes, sir. "What We Remember Best of You, Heng. Since you only remember the best in people, we only remember the best of you. With your hands stained by juice, you brought home gallons, cans of evergreen blackberries for mom's pies and jams. You wake up before dad could rouse you to go duck hunting. You cup scow your way through the outdoors, which you already explored. And you stood on your moving bike, a thrill to behold. Heng, you found redeemable beer bottles in dead-end streets. You mowed dandelion lawns for 2 bits. You brought home bowling trophies. You carry your own winning cue stick, always the sport, always the athlete. You played a 35-pound salmon on a 20-pound test line. And you were the first to get your limit of razor clams. Heng, you started working in a family restaurant at age 12. And you kept coming back to Aberdeen because it was your hometown, which you loved, as you did all your friends and relatives who remember you on this day. And we remember only the best of you, Heng, because the best is what you remember of everyone."
A very friendly man, Heng. Well respected in Aberdeen. Did you know him through his life there?
Yes, he was.
And did people know of his landing that 35-pound salmon?
Oh, yes.
So that's an adventure that would often be told around a table because it was such an exciting affair. But he was remarkable in many ways, quite the athlete, quite the sport.
Yeah, what happened was this, Heng, because he wouldn't accept me as his older brother when he came from China. And then, so we had quarrels and little fights, and you know, till I became a bookworm, he became an athlete. So that's how we made our peace.
Mm-hmm. So, and did he, what is the name of the person who we can look up in Wikipedia?
His son. Heng Woon Jr.
Heng Woon Jr.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a name for you to do some research on.
From Aberdeen.
From Aberdeen.
Aberdeen will also have a notable who was a Nobel winner in physics. And we have Ed Murray, the former mayor of Seattle, came from Aberdeen. And we all, in Aberdeen, we also had probably the worst serial killer in the state of Washington. He was supposed to have killed like 140 men in the, back in the early 1900s. Okay. From what I heard, he had a tavern above the Wishkaw River. People come in, he robbed them, tied them up, and dropped them down the trapdoor.
Wow.
Aberdeen was known as the hellhole of the Pacific. In the,
you avoided that poem. You didn't write one about that.
No, I didn't write that. I didn't find out about this till recently, that Aberdeen had that kind of history. Yeah.
Well, in the places that you've lived, the rooms that you have lived in, you often found a wealth of poetry ideas. Didn't matter where you were, the room seemed to have its own mental disposition, or I should say cerebral ambience about it, that you could pick up on that, and your poems came about from the rooms. And one of them is on page 22, "In My Little Room."
I forget when this was written. "In My Little Room. In my little room, the emperor removes his robe, and we chat about the mechanics of winning an election. I came, I saw, I conquer," he says. "When the moon comes out above the dilapidated warehouse, he asked me the profanity of going to the moon and back again to the same ghetto room. "If it pleases your majesty," I say, "the gods make the ghettos." "I am king," says the emperor. "I shall have no gods." And he shakes, nearly spilling his oolong tea. And when he has calmed down enough, I drop 2 lumps of sugar into his cup. He marvels at my countless book in integration theory and digital watch. "Had I one of those," he says, "I would have timed my crossing the Rubicon at 18. And what barbarian woman would not have given herself for that?" He yawns imperially over my utensils, books, and card, and asks me to cross the Rubicon with him. And I nod while doing tax equations for his majesty, because the hour is late. He is delighted with the hot chocolate I made on a hot plate. And after making a rough estimate of the roaches on the wall, he sleeps on my cot as any sovereign would. I rattle my typewriter like a machine gun all night, partly because it's my habit, and partly to protect my friend, the emperor. For though he has crossed the Rubicon with the bravest men, he has yet to sleep a single night in the ghetto.
Rather comic ending that the emperor has to come down to have a good sleep in the ghetto room. Now, crossing the Rubicon seems to me as one of your iconic boundaries.
Yes.
You've used it in, I think, one of the poems you just read a while ago. But here again, the Rubicon, crossing the Rubicon, it doesn't matter whether it's Caesar or Pompey or an emperor or whoever it might be, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Genghis Khan. But crossing Rubicons, does that ring an important sort of...
Well, I crossed the Pacific when I came here at age 12. So, yeah.
And you think of that as a Rubicon.
It's a demarcation of one's life.
That's right. So you don't really need to invent greatly when you've got something that already stands for that significant edge, ledge, boundary, bridge, whatever you want to call it, right? The other room poem, you will find madness in a room's disarray.
Okay, well, you can see that this is disarray, okay? Disarray, so...
we're happy with it.
Okay, good. Another room poem. "You will find madness in a room's disarray, or you find a room full of madness, depending how you look and how others look at you. Poetry is supposed to be an imaginary garden, but is filled with real toes. And here you are, pacing amid clothes, paper, pizza crust, electrical wiring. Something has come loose. Yet this is the moment you waited for. You've finally become careless of managed growth, speech acts, the toiletry, notable men. Now you simply feel inexplicable peace. Something money cannot buy. Suddenly you have an ample supply. Try as others might to purchase a room full of air. You have it just for the breathing. Thank you, my friend, for your generous love, without which the air above cannot be supported. Find me here. Please do, my friend. Find me in the dead center of it."
Well, you're in the dead center of your room's disarray.
Yeah, right.
In the madness of your room. Try as others might to purchase a room full of air. You have it just for the breathing. Wonderful line, that. Can't thank you enough. It's been a wonderful afternoon. Thank you.
And thank you for having me, David.
This is Sound Poetry. I've been your host, David Gilmore, with Seattle poet Kuhn Woon.